Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Global Supply Chain Practice Head for Morgan Phillips Executive Search. Today I'm delighted to have with us Keith Carter, Associate Professor for the NUS School of Computing. Keith is has a very interesting background. He comes from obviously academia now, but previous to this, he has run his own company. And also, he comes from a long, long tenure with Estée Lauder, the cosmetics manufacturer, from 1999 to 2012, where he led their Global Supply Chain Center of Excellence. He was tasked with many strategic changes to the supply chain on a global basis. And prior to that, also, he had a stint within Accenture and within Wall Street and financial institutions. So all of this make him a very interesting profile, and I'm very happy that he was able to join us today. He also wrote a book, Actionable Intelligence, A Guide to Delivering Business Results with Big Data Fast, which is very interesting, and basically it established the expert guidance in terms of how do you build a culture on fact-based decision-making. And he's also, as part of his mandate as a consultant, working with retail and supply chain companies like Gucci, Procter & Gamble, Bolloré, Panasonic, as well as financial services companies like Goldman Sachs, DBS, China Construction Bank, KPMG. Outside of work, on a personal level, he's an avid sportsman, he's an author, he's a private pilot, he's a fencer and a family man. Born in Long Island, he has spent most of his life in New York until moving to Singapore in 2012, where he's currently residing. So Keith, welcome and a pleasure to have you with us today.
Glad to be with you, Rod.
So let's start on a personal note first. I mean, what attracted you to Asia? I mean, New York is a pretty good place. It seems to treat you quite well. So why did you join us in Singapore in the first place?
New York is a great place, and I still think very fondly of New York. I enjoy Singapore a lot too, and my kids sometimes will ask me, "Daddy, when are we going back to New York?" And I quietly don't answer them because of the very challenging school system here. Sometimes they would lead a protest around the house, protest, because they would like to go back to New York earlier in their time here. But we've stuck it out and they've built their friendships. So I think that's very good. And one of the key goals was getting a great school education here for my kids in local schools. So that was achieved. They were quite challenged. The other was to, as my wife likes to put it, to globalize. I was born in New York, worked in New York, school in New York, everything in New York, and then came to Singapore. So been the last piece would be the excitement and the growth and the activity and the energy and the curiosity, everything that is here to see in a emerging and changing side of the world. That it's not as simple as, oh, just take it from New York and do something here. It's a brand new way, perhaps, for us to move forward. So I thought, hey, this would be a great way to be part of what has been a tremendous amount of change here in Singapore, too. And I was glad that the university offered the opportunity.
Yeah. Interesting. Fascinating, actually. And let's backtrack a little bit, because, again, you have a fascinating profile. I mean, I think it's almost one of a kind in terms of the type of people that we've had on the podcast. Because you started with your consulting, right? So in Accenture, in Wall Street. So you kind of, from financial services, you ended up being an expert in supply chain, big data, machine learning. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, I also asked myself that question when I was walking through the parking lot of Estee Lauder on the first day. And I could smell from the factory the perfume coming out. And as a young boy, I used to tell my mom, you can't wear perfume when I'm eating breakfast. Otherwise, I won't eat breakfast. So that was quite a transition to work at a perfume factory, coming out of Wall Street at Goldman Sachs, Solomon Brothers and others. But there was a core opportunity I felt. First is that both need data. On Wall Street, one of the things I'd worked on with Goldman was understanding who they were doing business with, what type of exposure and the investment there would be. And not surprisingly, that is asked a lot inside of a manufacturing company. Who are we doing business with? What's the supply chain risk? So while the types of goals and activity might be different, but the decision-making and the information that's necessary and the pace of information that's needed is the same.
Mm. Yes.
So it was quite translatable coming in. The words and such and the terminology was different. But that core, where are we today? Are we happy or sad? And how do we win tomorrow? Is foundational to every business.
Mm. And tell us a little bit, because I think there's a lot of, obviously you work with Acelodo for 13 years, so that's a long time. What were some of your main learning points of that global role, right? Because you did a lot of projects around global supply chain intelligence, around leveraging data, around improving supply chain of Acelodo. So if you were to reflect back, what were some of the key takeaways from that period?
It was, first of all, the family, the Lauder family screen. They have put in a culture there where the average age, sorry, not age, but the average tenure of people is 15 years. And so people stay very conservative. They never did layoffs, for example, because they were conservative in hiring in the first place, and profitable for the past 50 plus years, every single year. So a very well-run organization. Not every board can do that, can say that. But then, and then beyond that is, as a young 28-year-old joining the company, I came in as a director. And one of the first interesting experiences I had was just having a team where everyone was older than I was, but reported to me. And that was interesting. I took it on as an exciting challenge. Certainly, it was a great learning experience. I always had friends when I was younger who were older than I was. Like, I always hung out with the older kids in a sense. So I felt it was okay. But of course, there's a different dynamic there as well. And then the responsibility, though, you talk about what you asked me about. What are the key aspects? I thought there were a couple. One thing at the beginning of my time at Estee was converting us from proposing that we should convert from fax to web in terms of processing orders. So we were still doing like 10,000 purchase orders by fax back in 1999. That was interesting. Well, who remembers the fax machine now, right?
Yeah, some of our listeners probably don't know what that is.
Yes, that's
Google
right.
It, yeah.
And one of the most poignant discussions I had about that, when we were very excited, we said, look, if we could remove the fax machine, we will reduce the lead time to order, because it normally took 3 days to process a fax. And we can have the supplier automatically, like right there, confirm our purchase order on a web page. There'll be less errors. We'll have less time. And the only question I got from finance was, oh, less time? Less people. How many headcount are you going to reduce?
Typical, yeah.
So I remember one of the VPs at the time said, Keith, don't talk about the time savings. Just talk about the benefit and quality and how we'll have less inventory and all those types of things. So that was a very important lesson that I still share today. When you're proposing a business project, the time savings is not the key thing. You have to very much say, this is what we're going to do better, or this is what will improve beyond just the time. Otherwise, you lose headcount. That was at the start. So at the end, the big thing that we did back in, starting on a journey toward end-to-end supply chain visibility back in 2007 was, after going through several years of SAP implementation, we realized that we still were missing visibility end to end, meaning this. You look at your supply chain. So what does SAP cover? Manufacturing, warehouse, your order going out of distribution, and maybe the incoming supply from your first tier suppliers. What are you missing? You're missing your supplier's capacity. You're missing visibility to your tier two suppliers. And then on the other side, from a customer perspective, you're missing social media, you're missing your international retailer, different channels, e-commerce, your outsourced e-commerce retailer isn't on there as well. So you're missing whole swaths of input in terms of data visibility. that would allow you to have end-to-end supply chain. So we put out this vision. It was called Project Vision. And we said, how do we have true end-to-end view so that the sales team can know when the train is going to come into the station? When is the product really going to be available? And then knowing that, they can feel a lot more comfortable with their promotion, how they're going to go to market, etc. And back at the other side, we can, instead of blaming forecasting all the time, we can actually look and see supply forecast. Was how accurate was that? What is our true lead time, critical lead time to manufacture? So we put together this view, Project Vision, based on the principle of actionable intelligence, having the right information in the right person's hands at the right time in order to improve outcomes. And that's not a new terminology. In the World War II, it was highly used in order to identify risks and opportunities. Any good government uses it. For some reason, companies today have forgotten they need an intelligence service. This is not a friendly thing between companies. You know, oh, let's sing Kumbaya together and go to market and split the market share evenly, right? We go in and see how much more we can get. And it's been around for thousands of years. And in my book, I talk about how Zhuge Liang, who's one of the famous Chinese generals, had a 360-degree view of the battlefield and the communities that they were going to fight near or in. He had to know the weather. He had to know whether the people that they were around would give the army food. He had to know the morale of his troops. He had to know how to demoralize the enemy. He had to know the enemy very, very well, to the point of were they paying their troops and other things like this. And as a result, he was able to project the battle so that the general he was advising, Liu Bei, would be able to win more frequently. And I believe that's still a principle that thousands of years later, any leader in a business needs to take note of. They have to have actionable intelligence, not on a quarterly basis, not even at month end, but on a daily basis. Know what's their risks and opportunities. And that's what we were able to present through Project Vision Real Estate Order.
Yes.
And you'll see the results. We look at the return on invested capital. If you look back at 2008, 9, 10, as we went into adoption of that, and you look at return on invested capital today, you'll see that as they became, under Fabrizio Freda's leadership, CEO from Procter & Gamble came in and asked for everyone to be data-driven, and doubled, more than doubled, got into double digits, our return on invested capital, went into 20%+ in terms of return on invested capital, and something that's been sustained, and that set Estee Lauder apart from all the other cosmetics firms, and now going on 10 years.
Wow. Impressive. Thanks for sharing that. And if you had to, come back to the book, right, Actionable Intelligence, maybe let's go. So Estee Lauder is one important case study. And you've done in the meantime, all this year and maybe more recently. So talking about some of the companies that you're dealing with we've been dealing with in the last 1, 2, 3 years. Can you tell us some more examples of how you can and how this kind of comes to life, right? This term of actionable intelligence.
In particular, there's a company that comes to mind for a major transportation company here in Singapore, and they still use the visibility that we gave to them. They wanted to understand, they were under intense pressure in their procurement department to reduce the amount of inventory that they had and the wrong inventory. You can have a lot of inventory, but if it's not what you need, it's the double whammy, right? What was continuously happening is they couldn't get into their repair shop the right parts. And sometimes they'd have transportation systems or cars or other things that they have. I don't want to mention because I don't want to give too much away, but where they wouldn't be able to get them out of the shop and the repair and maintenance units were saying, it's not our fault. It's the fault of procurement and inventory. We don't have the things. And they had SAP as a planning system. And they have a long time. And that's a very good thing. But what they couldn't see was the maintenance plan versus what the critical lead time was of their material. And also sharing that information so they knew important information like what should I bring in off the truck first? Where do I have it go? Do I cross dock it? Things like that that can save days of time actually. Especially when you're on a very strict shift schedule. And sometimes when you run out of time, that's it. That's the end of the day. I'm not going to receive it until a few days from now. So that's where having and using a tool like in that place, ClickView, help them to pull data from SAP and another system that they had to put it together and allow the procurement, inventory, and maintenance shop to see where they were at any one time, place order a bit faster, not have to wait on email, not have to ask. And there are such a thing as a dumb question, meaning, do you have the inventory? That's a dumb question, I believe, today. We should know that. The smarter question is, I see you have the inventory. Can I have it for this emergency? And if, you know, that, and then that's where you do a transformative result. So from Estee Lauder, we did replicated that at this particular transportation company.
Yes, yes.
And similar, multi-systems typically were separate, all different types of reasons, security, all this and that I don't want to share. Change the culture, share the data.
Together, yeah. And what do you, I mean, let's talk about principles because I think fundamentally a lot of companies understand this, but at the principle level, I mean, everybody agrees that, you know, you need data to take correct decisions. But at the principle level, what do you feel that is the key principles that need to be put in place? And what do you think is are the major mistakes that companies sometimes make when addressing it? Because sometimes they buy very expensive tools or very expensive systems and it still fails through the implementation, right?
Yeah, I think the first key principle is never the system that's the problem, actually. Typically, no matter what system people put in, there's a way to work around the system as well. It's always the people and the culture. At the core is intelligence is completely optional. I can always execute without having to look up anything. I can place my order. I didn't have to look. And maybe I can do all my activity and not be held accountable because I don't have enough information to hold people accountable. So what this leads to is two things. Number one, senior leaders have to change the culture and say, don't just tell me the situation. Come and show me the situation. Then right behind that, the middle management and IT department have to work together very carefully. And sit together earlier in the year and say, I wonder what are the key questions that, based on this strategy, that I'm going to get asked this year? And let me have the answers ready. Let me invest and have ready answers so that when they come screaming down, why isn't my order here? Or how come I didn't make return on investment here? I have the answer already. How many companies do that? Most are reactive. Most are waiting for a consultant to advise them on what questions they should answer. And those are not the right things. And too many companies are trying to skip ahead. Oh, let me just give it to AI and it'll tell me what I should do next in my company. And it couldn't be further from the truth. So the core principle is not AI as a system. What's my culture? Am I asking for data-driven and, you know, decision making? Am I asking for that at a senior level? And IT, are you an enabler? And middle management, are you preparing ahead of time so you're ready to answer?
Excellent. And since we mentioned AI, and I think, you know, this buzzwords today, AI, machine learning, you know, that's, you know, you hear it thrown away. too much, right? It's overused. But let's, and I think we shared before the podcast some thoughts, and I mean, I think you have some strong opinions also about this. Maybe share a little bit in terms of, you know, are we putting the cart before the horse? I mean, all this AI, I mean, without proper data, you know, people are using Excel, but they're talking about AI. We don't have consolidated data even. I mean, how does this all play into?
I always like the story, the emperor has no clothes. Do you know the story? Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful story, just for maybe some who hadn't read it, got it read to them, that a emperor surrounded by his wonderful and intelligent counselors, and two people come from over another valley, and they promise to make the emperor a beautiful set of new clothing. And they go up into a room, and they ask for a barrel of gold in order to make it. They're going to make it from the finest of gold cloth, right? And they go up there, and the king delegates and says, look, tell me how the project is going. How are they? And so the king's advisor goes up and sees, and the people are there weaving and everything, putting together. And they say, look at this beautiful gold. Only a person with the most intelligent and the best creativity can see what we've created here. And the advisor, not wanting to be embarrassed, says, oh, I can see how wonderful it looks, because, you know, only the most intelligent and can see. And so the second level advisor, or the first advisor, said, look at what they're making up there. And they naturally ask for more gold, because they promise it's going to become even better. The second level advisor goes, and not to be embarrassed, also says, oh, this is looking wonderful. Finally, the king goes, and they bring the outfit down to the king, and with great pomp and circumstance, and dress the king in it. And the king says, not to be embarrassed, looks at it, and of course doesn't see, but is saying, wow, this is a beautiful thing, and weighs it, and then walks through the town, and everyone, all the king's people, are clapping, because who would dare to say the king doesn't look great? Get your head chopped off. This looks wonderful. And just one naive little boy in the crowd says, oh, the king has no clothes on. And then everyone laughs, and the king is embarrassed, and the two robbers made off with the gold. I don't want to get any lawsuits, so I don't say who those robbers might be. But I will say, I feel that there's this, what is commonly termed as a hype cycle. A few years ago, we said that virtual reality was going to be in every warehouse. Google Glass was going to be on every face. Today, people are saying that every company is going to be run by AI. We heard that big ERP systems are going to provide unbelievable returns on investment, and et cetera, et cetera. Needless to say, there's some relationship between all these three things and that story I just told. I think we're at the same point with AI. First of all, so I know some people might be angry already, but let me make it a little bit angrier still. We are not anywhere close to AI. AI, as defined by Isaac Asimov in his famous story, Foundation, if you haven't read it, again, something awesome to read, and you'll get a true picture of the math required to think about AI and what an AI might interact with humans be. If I start off with what AI ought to look like, I need some information like what should my behavior be as an intelligence? What should my desires be? What should my intentions be? And there's actually a BDI framework in intelligent systems design. What do you think is the key missing component? Even if we had the math, assuming we had the math, what's missing today? Does any of our credit card systems capture intention, desire, behavior? Do any of our SAP systems or other things capture those three data points? Not at all. So we don't even have the data today to feed an AI if we wanted to, so that it could learn to behave like us. So I believe the biggest challenge that we'll have for a while is, given that even if we had the math, would be to know how we capture feelings, the real desire as to why we bought something, etc. Today, we know that we did buy something. We know the direction. We know how often we buy, things like this. But those are very observable things, right? So AI, artificial intelligence, isn't here. But there is a subset of it which we do have. Fast pattern matching, which is machine learning. We can feed a set of data into a mathematical formula, a different set of statistical formulas, actually. But then it can use that to find patterns and say, the next most, given this similar set of data, I believe that this might be the next likely action. That we have today. And it works very nicely. You look at Google, it maps in the morning, and it tells you, Keith, you're going to have how much time on your commute, because it already knows that my behavior is I'm going to go to the school and how far and what route I normally take and what the best route is because of the traffic, and it's put that together. That's fast pattern matching. Does Google Maps care whether I get there on time? No. Is it saying to me, Keith, why are you going to NUS today? Is this a good career for you? No. And that's artificial intelligence.
That's an awesome example. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's true. It's true. Because I mean, that's the, I think fundamentally, and myself included, I mean, people are not quite getting the concepts, but they're throwing it around. And then if we are to bring it to the realm of supply chain, and we have to make it really, let's say, pragmatic and let's say the things that a VP of supply chain or chief supply chain officer can or wants to implement next year in his organization to improve the effectiveness, cut cost, or basically, I don't know, improve his network yield. What would that thing be? I mean, is it related to machine learning? Is it related, I think we spoke about RPA, robotic process automation? Is it related to digitalization, which used to be the hype terms a couple of years ago, but now it's in exchange? What would you say?
I think it's all of the above, but there's an order to it. Digitalization is critical, absolutely. Getting away from handwritten documents and trying to get most of your business into a system is a very clear first step. By the way, who out there would leave home without their cell phone? No one these days, right? Now, we didn't have to get trained on how to use a cell phone, but it provides us something so necessary. Information. Timely information to the right person, who's me. And when I want to take an action, I can send it out to people or know where I'm going or know what time I'm going to arrive there. So I really have actionable intelligence delivered to me on my phone. So one of the first questions that any business user, business leader should be thinking is, how much of my business can I run from my mobile phone? Because if it's less than 50%, you need to improve today. Your competitors are rushing into it. And your competitors are Amazon. I mean, I just ordered 5 tablets today to a different office. And it came. It's here. I have the tablets done. I clicked a few buttons and I did it. I'm a customer of Amazon. They showed me all the whole customer journey. And it was received at a place I've never received something at before ever. And it's here, done. Customer engaged with the mobile phone, driver engaged with the mobile phone mapping, showing where they went. They didn't have to buy any extra hardware, and all the information that was there that they needed to do was there. They didn't bother get caught up in, oh, my customer information is on my driver's mobile phone, all the compliance things. It's not compatible with my big ERP system that I spent millions on. Big deal. You, what is it called in economics? Sunk cost. You go and you say, what can I do now that mobile is here to stay? In order to be mobile, that implies that you're digital because you have to have data, you have to have the things available. In order to be mobile, you have to access a system somewhere. It has to be in the cloud. We talk then about security. But there's one other key piece, and you mention it, in order to be mobile, and to engage with people, when you're looking at your phone, you don't want to wait, right? We're all in the WhatsApp and WeChat or whatever, where we send something out and we want an instant response from everyone. especially if we're a customer. So now, what do you do? Do you hire more customer service people? Or do you give your customer service people a force multiplier? And I believe in 2019, let me say it even stronger. In 2019, robotic process automation drives the industry forward for every company. When they're able to respond instantly to a customer's request, and they put that force multiplier alongside of their customer service agent, that is what delights the customer. And that's what we're all expecting these days. And that's why we don't leave home without our mobile phone.
Mm. Yeah, it's an instant gratification type of an environment. Amazon and other sites as such have enforced. But let's go a little bit deeper, because I think a lot of the people maybe, and myself included, RPA is a fairly new term again. Let's go into some examples. I mean, maybe we talk specifically at certain examples that you know of where this was applied or is going to be applied, and what results they yielded.
I'm very angry about this, as I share with you.
Yeah.
In 2006, we generated our first SNOP deck automatically in PowerPoint from Excel tables. Back in 2006, we used some macros. We looked at, and what we did was we pulled data. We had Excel. You can pull through an ODPC connection. Sorry, we can connect to a database automatically with Excel. Pull the data in. Macro says, oh, what was the growth? Well, 0.5 basis points from quarter to quarter, from month to month is this. Okay, 27 brands. Let's just replicate and then generate. And here's my chart. I'm ready to go. So I don't want to make robotic process automation too complex. What I wanted to do is do the things that take me a time to do, but a computer could perfectly well do, actually.
So basically automating
your job.
Routine tasks.
Automating the answer to a question and answering it with data routinely. Everyone has a set of, if you looked at your email box, I'm willing to bet that you have a set of questions that you're asked all the time, either for leaders, when are you available to meet? Right. That'll be 80% of their inbox. And if there was something there that could automatically schedule for them and give them enough time to drive there and to set up make sure the room, everything was aligned, the only thing the leader would have left to do was to make sure the agenda and the minutes were set. Right?
Yes. And to make sure that he agrees to the meeting. But actually, I'll give you an example, because I was put in that situation a couple of weeks ago where I wanted to. So I don't have it, and I need to buy it for myself. But I was communicating with a C-level executive for a technology company, and then I come back. He comes back because he's seeing a name, and then that name starts to write to me, okay, the agenda,
yes.
And then the signature. This is an AI or some
yes.
sort of a, you know, chat box. I'm like, wow. And then I'm talking to that thing.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, it schedules the meeting, and then they have to reschedule, and it's still done through the...
That's right.
So it was fantastic. I'm like, wow, that must save the guy a lot of time.
I'm so glad you mentioned it. One of the services is called X.AI, and I share that in my presentations around the world, that this is something that saves a lot of time. But, and I want to emphasize this, it's not... that people in the audience typically look at the person who's a secretary in the room because they're like, oh, no, will they lose their job? And I say, look, my personal assistant does more intelligent things, has a higher value-added job than simply scheduling a meeting. She goes and helps make sure we've got the agenda, that we have the minutes, that we have called people to make sure they're coming. Those are things that the AI can't do. But the scheduling, what room and things like that, it can perfectly do well. This is where I believe there's a very good balance between the machine and the person. And furthermore, that we ought to have the persons that were doing that job have a higher level job. I believe we're at a time when we're going to create even more jobs than ever before. And the reason I say that, we have more people, we're in contact with many more people at any one time. Anyone around the world can get in touch with us. No one has free time these days. It's funny. We have all this automation. We have instant food. We have instant cabs. We have instant flights. We have instant deliveries. And we have less time. How did that happen, Roger? What happened? I thought we were supposed to be waking up at 10. The job is already complete for us. Asleep, you know, at 9. Where did that go, right? We have everything is automated. We don't find food, nothing. You want a meal?
Yeah,
it's there in 30 minutes, right? You don't have to cook. You don't have to wash, right? And we have less time. So what happened? And I think we have to ask ourselves a serious question sometime in this discussion, Radu. What are we actually using our time for? We really have to ask ourselves this question. But let me come back to this practical point. You talk about the scheduling a meeting. I want to bring it to answering a purchase order. Demonstrated earlier this week to 100 plus suppliers at Subway. Subway, you know, the sandwich maker, I spoke at their annual supplier dinner. And I said, in 2019, this is the AI that you guys want. And showed how when they send a email to me and say, Keith, what's the status of my purchase order? Purchase order with this product on it, or purchase order with this number. They got a response back from a system that looked at the various information that would make up the status of that purchase order, telling them instantly what the status was. And also gave them additional advice. Mm. Here's some other purchase you didn't ask me about that's also coming up. Now, that won't answer every question, but boy, it'll cut down 60% of the email box and let you really spend a bit more time on the 40% that is harder. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is something that is very clear. And I think another example that I was reading about, and it's done in IKEA. I mean, actually, even here in Singapore, if you noticed, most of the websites of the government now have that chat box, you know, different names of the chat box. And then for normal questions, I mean, for simple enough questions, they just automated that process, which, again, takes away the time that you have to call the machine and another human being answering the same question over and over again, which is a little bit mind-numbing, right?
Right.
But I wanted to also bring to this question, because you have all these tools, you have RPA, but then, you know, executives typically, right, at the C-level, at the chief supply chain officer level, they want to implement these changes. But there's a set of mistakes that are done or that are made over and over again. So whether it is, I don't know, it's a top-down. So they try to force the change through the necks of the or the throats of the people, and then there's resistance from the bottom. Whether it is, you know, you kind of buy a Porsche and all you need is a Toyota. Whether it is, there's different mistakes that occur. So I'm just curious, from your perspective, in this process of changing and adapting the organizations, what are some of the mistakes that you've seen done, made? So
the biggest mistake is, I think, big system change, and not taking the time to do a commensurate big culture change. The funniest thing is that you spend millions on a system, but you won't spend $10,000 on training. You spend millions on a system, but you won't spend or millions of hours on a system, but you won't spend tens, hundreds of hours on the people. And as a result, I like the phrase here in Singapore, you change the hardware, but not the software. You have a brand new flat, but all the same habits of the before are still there. And that's one. The other side is that the system evaluation, the purpose has to be very, very sharp. Is it as easy and held to a very high standard? Is this thing as easy to embed in my life as the mobile phone? Because if it's not, my adoption won't be high or people will go around. And as we all know, If we talk to some of our friends, even if they have the mobile phone, they have trouble figuring out, oh, what's I can do more than just take a picture with this thing.
So common.
You know? Let's be honest.
Well, my 3-year-old probably knows to use my phone better than I do. So, yeah, that's for sure.
Exactly. So then the mistake I saw, for example, was a company that I worked with, and I won't, because it's a mistake, then I don't share so much, right? They spent millions of dollars, literally millions. I remember the annual spend on analytics was about $10 million. And we said, and one of the planners said to me, Keith, I can't use it. I have to go, in order to get an answer, I have to select one part number and then I can get a report. I have 1,000 parts. What do I do? And if I ask the IT department to change the report, they tell me come back in 3 months and everything like this. And we said, okay, forget about it. We'll give you here. What do you want? Okay, let's do like this. And literally with just a web page, we gave them a web page where they could look up things, and they threw away the $10 million plus whatever dollars that they had put in. And what did the web page do? Instead of the $10 million, very hard to use, cube, whatever system, with consultants and everyone behind it, the web page just looked at an AS400, it looked at a mainframe, and it looked at a more new generation system, put it all together. And when they typed in their planner number, it showed them all their things and what they had. That was the end. That's all they wanted. How much did it cost? It literally cost nothing. We had an intern build the web page. We had one of the IT guys in his spare time give us some of the hooks, and it was done. And we didn't go through the charter process. We didn't go through the project evaluation process. We didn't go through the vendor process. We didn't go through compliance. We didn't go through legal. We didn't ask for permission to access the systems either. And we got it done and demonstrated that it could work. And then they said, oh, okay, now let's make this official. But if we had gone the other way around, it would have been months and we would have had. So I think one of the other, there's several big mistakes to take away from the story. Number one is the governance process for data-driven decision-making is very different than the governance process for putting in a big scale manufacturing change or CapEx. Intelligence is speed. You need it now. Putting in a new machine in a warehouse, you take your time because you need to move space and everything and you plan for it, right? Intelligence, you need speed because your customers are asking about it now, or your competitors are doing something, or there's a new government regulation you need to respond to, and you need to make the best decision. I like to introduce to companies that they should have a separate process for intelligence, which is post-governance. Post-governance is what any intelligence agency in the world does. The CIA doesn't go to Congress and say, oh, please, can I have some money so that I can go and do this targeting right now? Let me tell you who it is and let me have you all come back from recess break and discuss. The situation is over, right? Instead, an intelligence service is given a bucket of money and they're given, you know, they're supposed to be fiduciary responsible with it. They go and get the tools and the people in place. They observe the risks and opportunities and they go after. And then when they win with improved outcomes, then at the end of the year, there's an assessment. What was the measurable deliverables that you had? There are two ways to win here. Number one is that you've actually measured the value of the data. Most companies don't measure the value of the data, which is another tremendous mistake. Number two is you've eliminated what is a fake governance process anyway. Oh, if you get this report, how much more return on investment will I have? Who can guess what the next having a better decision about a business can ever be? You don't even know that you had the decision to come up. How will you know how to value it, right, beforehand? And the last piece is that you need it to give a high adoption system So you had to really be on the ground with the people that needed the intelligence and give them something that fit their situation, not something that works all over the world all at the same time. It's never the case. It's never true. It doesn't work like that yet. We're not one world. We're just not, neither by culture nor by legal jurisdiction. And those things can make tremendous differences in what users adopt and can adopt. So those are our three starting points. So Radu, there's so many more, but we'll stop
there. Yes, let's stop there. But yeah, very, very good points. And it reminds me, we had on the podcast, Trolls, who's the CEO of Twill, which is a kind of an innovation by the Mars Group. And Twill uses a lot agile. So basically they work in 2 weeks sprints, they call it, right? Where they take something, they try, actually even the company itself was initially was started from an idea, and then that idea got funded by the Mars Group. But it's very much focused in some ways with that post-government type of approach that you mentioned, in the sense that they go, they do it, they take the feedback, they do the minimal viable product, they take the lessons from it, and then they improve again and again and again. But they do it fast, because speed is of the essence.
That's right.
And a lot of companies just get it. I mean, they just get to, once you grow big enough, unfortunately, you lose that. You lose that agility. You get stuck in the process. You get stuck in governance. You get stuck in the, I don't know, paperwork. And yeah, then you're just very slow. So the market can kind of punch you in the face sometimes. But if we had to come back to the point that you mentioned, which is critical, I feel, as well, and it's kind of the business that we're in, it's the people, right? It's the people, it's the culture, it's the mindset, right? The leaders should shift mindset before they shift systems, right? Because otherwise the system is used by people and will not work. What do you feel is also, what do you think is also maybe or should be top of the minds of the executives in the business, the C-level of the business, in terms of hiring, in terms of getting the right type of skill set, and what's that? What's the skills of the future? What do they need? What do businesses need?
This is a loaded question, because this once again has been another failure in the marketplace, which is going out and hiring a whole bunch of data scientists and thinking that that's going to solve your woes. And what we've saw in the past 2 years has been a push. You have, where are you going to get your next data scientist from? What should they be working on? How do you incorporate data scientists in? And then what happened is there was a bunch of people that were math geeks. They knew data science. Had no idea what business they were in. They were just from wherever. And someone came in and was leading the day. I can lead a data science team. Great. Good. And then, so, okay, what question do you want us to answer? And the business, not knowing what data science is, first of all, said, well, can you give us a better customer forecast? Of course, sales is the loudest, the first. We need better forecasts. Okay, the data scientists will go and look at the past forecasts and sales and everything, and then come up and run all sorts of statistical analysis. Here's a better forecast. We're predicting for you which customer will churn and what have you. And sales looks at it and sees that it's going to affect their sales target, that they're and also the same data scientist is saying, and we can reduce the inventory too. And they say, the general manager of the country says, now if I get less inventory, that means I'm not going to be able to sell. There's a forecast uptick. That means I'm going to have to increase my forecast in order to get the inventory I need in order to make my numbers this year. And inventory is not on my KPIs anyway, so I might as well just okay. So we get back to behavior, right? Yeah. So no matter what, and then of course one of the salespeople in the room will say, "But that number for Korea looks wrong because this data scientist didn't know that there were five different channels, and you know, one system had it grouped, one system did all the nuances." And ultimately, you ran into this stop where the business said, well, I don't trust what's coming out of that group. And anyway, when I ask them for something, it takes a long time for them to do it. And then the group is saying, well, no one talks to us and other people in the business. So, well, we go around them and we just get the report from our friend anyway. And then the data science group shrivels up and dies. So what happened? Data science is not a panacea. It's not even a solution by people unless they know the domain. And let me go one step further. unless they know the three-letter acronyms in your company. Because each company has its little terms and different exceptions, whatever's in the system. And, oh, this is an R, but in this market it's an S and whatever. That kills any type of machine learning or visualization that you would do, because you have to put in all those exceptions, all the different rules that need to be there. So my first advice to senior leaders is don't hire data scientists from the outside. Build people on the inside to be your data scientists, because the person who's using Excel is just one step away. All you need to do is teach them a few principles. They already know what was the hardest, your culture, all your terminology, where all the hidden bodies are, where the data is, who the guy in IT who they can get the data from. They have the relationships that cut through the red tape that no one new has. Once again, and I wish, Radu, you might go back over, look back at who's been making these suggestions. I want to just put something to our listeners, the listeners too. Who said in 2009 that all companies should have a data warehouse? And today people realize, oh, wait a second. The data warehouse with a cube structure was never the right answer. Because it didn't have social media. It didn't have all those other systems that weren't part. Who said you have to hire data scientists in 2016? Who was that company? And hold them accountable. Because dang blasted, every conference that you go to has people talk in that same, those same companies are talking about, well, you have to put AI in today. And here's the AI system that's going to do it for you. And there's going to be, what's going to happen in 2019? People are going to look back. The CFO is going to laugh again. Hey, IT department, you told me to put in AI this year, and look, no one's using it. Last year, you said hire a bunch of data scientists, and we're rolling that down. And look, the years before, you told me put in the data warehouse, and no one uses it. Everyone's still using Excel. But what's going on, right? When is the credibility of the same voices that tell us that these are the things you have to do? When will that credibility be taken away? And I think we really need to do a very good review over the past 10 years, because I think you'll find, Radu, that they're the same voices. They're the same companies that tell us to do, tell the whole industry to do the same things. And they're never held accountable. And let me go one step further. As we go into blockchain, the same voices are saying how blockchain is here. There's hardly a judge in the world that would look at a smart contract. There's hardly a jurisdiction in the world that will accept that. And, oh, well, let me put a blockchain into a supply chain, a food supply chain. What farmer has a blockchain system ready to go? Wait a second. Oh, let's put tagged lettuce. Tag, you know, one of the things that one big company is talking about, along with one of the other big companies that has suggested all these things, we're going to tag all leafy vegetables by 2019. Did you know that at the port in Singapore, as it comes off and goes into the wholesaler, half of the lettuce gets thrown away before it ever gets to the marketplace? So what are you going to do? Tag the whole thing with RFID tags. That's the only way for you to, or some IoT sensor, something, right? Because you have to connect it with a blockchain. The lettuce isn't just blockchain, right? You have to put something right. And what will you do? Throw away half of the tags that the farmer put on, the farmer in Indonesia put on, not the farmer in Jakarta, by the way, the farmer in Bandung. And what system at the port in Bandung is going to tag a blockchain? You just begin to think practically. And then you talk about blockchain again some more. I love blockchain. I think in the few years from now, let me just make sure. I think a few years from now, it'll be awesome. And there are some very good use cases right now that I can tell you about with the Federal Reserve that are actually using blockchain right now. They're very specific and it's very, very useful. But when it comes to blockchain and supply chain, we are very, very far away. And last question would be for any audience on this is, which of your IT departments are ready to handle this question? IT, can you help me decrypt the message the bill of material that's on the blockchain, for some reason it's not unencrypting on my computer. And there's a mistake. I received 1,000 by accident. Come on.
Yeah. It's true. And back to the hype, right? So, but I think it's in our human nature too. And I will not go further to ask you in terms of, because I'm sure you have some culprits for this and some guilty, let's say, not people, maybe organization for this. And I don't want us to be sued as well. So that get into
no,
that.
No,
but
no,
I have
no.
My own pet peeves. But
I think we should get fat. Based about it,
yes, correct. Because they do tend to get away over and over again. And they also do tend to charge a lot of money to implement this consulting gigs. So now you're with academians, and I kind of drawing to the conclusion. But I wanted to also ask you. You know, you obviously teach students nowadays. I think education nowadays is going through a transformation as well. What do you see as the basically also from people that are coming in through the university system right now? I mean, what kind of skills do they need to learn and kind of maybe mindsets even? Because, I mean, what you learn sometimes at university nowadays, by the time you finish, might not be that relevant anymore almost.
You know, the best skill, the absolute best skill anyone can have these days, I believe, is the ability to Google things.
Mm.
I mean, and the boldness to do that at anytime, all the time. There's a risk, of course. I mean, yeah, Google can steer you and so forth and so on, and they pick up, and if they decide to do evil, then blah, blah, blah. All those things are true. That's true. But what I come to is this, though. The reason Google takes 95% plus of the search is because it's practical. We use it, and it gives us an answer that we're looking for. Hate it or love it. Now, the school system has to dramatically change. We need to be thinking like Google, like Facebook. How do we train the next 100 million to be awesome in these roles? Cybersecurity, real AI when it comes, but before that, machine learning, before that, visualization, before that, data engineering, before that, data acquisition, okay? Before that, digitalization and getting good processes in place. Asking really good questions. I mean, being curious is key as well. Being able to ask more questions as well. And knowing where I can get the answers. That those are the things that we have to have. And those are the things that at National University of Singapore, I love teaching my students. I'm teaching a machine learning class. And my students went through a journey. They knew they had a mixture of Python capability, but they needed to get better at it. They used Jupyter Notebook so they could really visualize what their code was doing. I think that's essential because then you remove the mystery of what's happening as you go through. And then now they're doing, they're taking what they did with machine learning. And normally with a machine learning course, you stop at one critical point, which is how accurate did you get your model? But we know in business, the business leader doesn't care about the accuracy of your model. The business leader wants to know, should I do this next? What's my next move? So my students, I'm taking them through algorithmic trading and applying machine learning to that. And that's making them not only get accurate models, but then have to deal with new information all the time and actually take an action. Do I invest or not? Do I buy or sell? The ultimate trader. And that's what every business does, right? We buy at one price and hopefully we sell at a higher price. So whether you're making widgets or you're a stockbroker, it's the same type of job. And they're learning that in class. And what it's made them do is go beyond the theory of decision trees and neural networks and long short-term memory, all those types of models, and realize, hey, wait a second. I should run a couple models at a time. I really need to experiment. I need additional data, which is where we started from. I can't just take my sales, past sales. I need other environmental factors. I need a full situational view to feed into my machine learning model. And as they do that and they get better and better at pricing the buy, procurement, and pricing the sell, sales, and knowing, and in between, knowing the how to massage and prepare for that sale, which is our operations, they actually take what's the machine learning and add a cognitive ability to it and then add the body to take action, which is the trading system. I think it's that skill set which combines the curiosity with the interest in acquiring the data, with the experimentation to see what's going to work, and then the boldness to act on it that every employee needs to have coming up. And we can't train it. There's not enough seats at National University of Singapore in my classroom for it. So we need to, Radu, come up with a way that we can do this with 100 million people around the world. I'm working with the British Virgin Islands government, and they're coming here 2 weeks from now. The head of the president of the college, we're sitting together to go through how do we train that whole country on this. We're meeting with another country in Asia to go and look at their whole country to do this. And one of the things that we believe as a platform, something a little bit different than Coursera and others, is taking it down one level, which is to micro learning. And I think micro learning, we're going to try it out. Let's experiment. Let's go. Let's do that Skunkworks project that I said, hey, we're sitting with the people and we're going to be finding out from them, what do you really need to do in your economy in order to go fast? Give them micro learning so that as they walk out of work, they can learn these key principles, try these things out, and then go back into the office the next day and say, hey, boss, I can do this. And when the boss sees that they can do it and it delivers a result, thumbs up.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, it's a great summary. And that reminds me of the conversation that we had also on the podcast with Dr. Yossi Sheffi from MIT. And Dr. Sheffi was also, Professor Sheffi was also sharing that at MIT, he's putting more and more of the courses online. He's creating models where it becomes accessible to more and more people, because it should be like this, right? And education is more, it's less and less about the actual things that you learn at a certain point in time. It's more about the mindset of constantly re-educating, relearning, unlearning things, and being curious. And, you know, like you rightfully mentioned, being able to micro implement it in your community, in your town, in your city, in your village, even, right, in your company, in your department, in your team, and then take it forward and forward and forward, because it kind of is a reinforcing loop in which you get more and more confidence from the action that you've taken.
That's right.
So now, really, really exciting. And I mean,
Can I just add that I feel we are at a time where we're going to create more jobs than ever before. Let me give an example. Did you know that I just found this out? Back in the 1800s, they had streetlights. How were the streetlights turned on?
Manually?
Yeah, exactly. People actually had to, in Paris, they had troops of people, tropes, if you would, not troops, but tropes that would go through with a nice, sometimes an elaborate show, and light the gas lamps by hand as they went along the entire street. We don't do that today. That job doesn't exist, except for maybe at Disney World or something like that. And so jobs that we have been used to will go away in this generation. If you're just sitting there answering purchase orders today, that job should go away. I mean, I think no one would say, oh, we should go back to lighting gas lamps. They were dangerous, and also, if they caught on fire. By the way, people shouldn't probably answer purchase orders. A lot of times we type a digit wrong and things like that. But we have more people in France, right? It's not that less people are employed or something. They do more intelligent jobs. The people that we train on machine learning, the students that I'm teaching now, they're going to come into jobs like cyber, et cetera, and there's going to be so many more of them. There's definitely a job for a person who will be teaching AI and there's going to be a completely new job of how to dispose of an intelligent, useful AI. We don't have that job spec yet, but it's coming. There's going to be a completely, there's a job right now of blockchain programming, which is a good job, by the way, in spite of what I said about it, because it will be useful in the future. There's going to be a job to dispose of blockchains somehow, or at least control them or other things as well. There are jobs coming up that we can't even possibly, some of us can't imagine. But for those of us that can imagine, thank you. Because you're going to be creating the next 100 million jobs that we're going to need to have gainful employment, and that at the end of the day provides the couple things that any human wants to have, which is recognition.
Mm. Super. Well, on that note, Professor Keith, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate the sharing, appreciate the stories, appreciate the insights, and it was a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure too, Radu. Really good to talk with you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radupalamario.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.